We had the real Miss Karatidis, though she had nothing fresh to report. Moriarty was in a cold fury. I was in a hot one. We'd bagged a brace of Swiss apiece, but were no better for it. I imagine murder charges could have been involved. Worse, according to Swiss mores, we'd left an untidy mess. Adolf Lavenza was a shed snakeskin. All we could do was mark the thin man while he sniffed over the countryside. I was no longer confident he had a hope of running down Mabus. Geneva is not Paris. There's nothing to do at night. Sophie was packed off on her travels again, following the thin man's traipse through verdant snowiness or whatever. She sent back mostly incident-less reports. The only thing that suggested we might have a trail left was that some lederhosen yodeler tried to shove her out of a boat on the Interlaken. She got a knife into his neck several times and pitched him overboard. He sank through wonderfully clear waters, ribbons of red unrolling from the gills she'd put in him. Tedium had got to her, and she was waxing poetic. Not a healthy thing for a woman or a murderer. An early sign of the vapours, or a perverse impulse to confess. To remind our bloodhound of his duty, we had Sophie roll a rock off a ridge at him as he ambled along the shore of the Daubensee. His deerstalker soaked by the splash, his nerve showed. She said he'd jumped like a grasshopper. Moriarty was not in a much better condition. In those days, he oscillated so badly I thought he'd do himself an injury. He ground his teeth, and his vertebrae creaked. He covered sheets of hotel notepaper with numbers and symbols. The staff at the Beau Rivage were afraid of him. He was showing his skull too much. I was just red-faced and irritable. Day-old numbers of the Times and the Gazette, with further revelations from Inspector Patterson, did nothing for my humour. The Yard was clearing its books, pinning decades of unsolved crimes on the Conduit Street ring. I admit most of the ones from the last 10 years were ours, but the 1809 disappearance of Benjamin Bathurst was almost certainly not Moriarty's doing, since he'd not yet been born. Constance Kent killed her brother without our help, though the professor owned a mosaic, Perseus brandishing the head of Medusa, the young murderess executed while doing her stretch in Millbank. On the 2nd of May, Sophie's regular cipher telegram came from the Englischer Hof in Meringen, a small alpine village. The thin man was expected to arrive on the morrow and travel on to Rosenloy, an even smaller alpine village, going a little out of the way to visit a tourist attraction, the Reichenbach Falls. Not one of her more interesting communiques. On the same tray was a telegram from Peter Steiler, who represented himself as landlord of the Englischer Hof. He broke sad news. Miss Karatidis had been found dead in her locked room, a knife in her breast. She was believed to have taken her own life. In her papers was found our address in Geneva. He trusted we would accept his condolences and wondered in a polite Swiss way whether we would make, i.e. pay for, funeral arrangements. He assured us there was no urgency. Even at this stage of the year, there was plentiful ice for the staving off of decay. Ah, Sophie. I considered the loss. Dead. And never the recipient of a basher special. The thin man must have tumbled her, I said. He knew she blamed him for her brother and got his blade in first. I'd have done the same. I'd not have tricked up that locked room mystery, though. Damned ostentatious. Detectives can't resist going melodramatic when they turn murderer. No, Moran, Moriarty said, eyes shining. The thin man won't be in Meringen until tomorrow. Another hand did this. Not that cretin Watson. Moriarty breathed the name by now an incantation. Mabus. He was already paging through Baedeker's Guide to Switzerland and the Alps, calculating the fastest route by scheduled train and hired trap. He was obsessed again. Moriarty didn't take kindly to nemesis. What about the detective? Moriarty was impatient with details. A minor matter. His usefulness is at an end. It would be untidy to leave him alive, though. Once business with Mabus is concluded, we shall pitch him off the waterfall. A frothing torrent at its base will make a suitable last resting place for the thin man of Baker Street. What say you to that, Moran?
I laid a hand on the Von Herder case.
It was long past time the air rifles saw use. 15. 2 days later, just after dawn, we enter Meringen, a stopover for alpinists on their way to Trollenberg, waterfall aficionados on their way to Reichenbach, and consumptives on their way to the grave. The professor called a halt just inside the village limits and got down from the trap. He would rouse the local constabulary to inquire about the Grecian lady's death. Moriarty going to the police, while I was to look up the Stiele at the Englischer Hof. The thin man and the thick head were likely in residence, and Moriarty had to avoid the detective. It was less likely I would be recognized, though I'd not forgotten that impertinent index card. "What about Mabuse?"
"He is either here or he has gone," said the professor, not being much help. "Be wary, Moran. He has proved himself incalculable."
"You can't be as fond of dangerous pursuits as me and keep your skin without being habitually wary. Bravery is not the same as stupidity. Indeed, if you've the nerve to dance with the big cats, you must always be alert." I resented Moriarty giving written instructions, with 15 separate diagrams on how to suck eggs. He should know Basham Moran better by now. Leaving Moriarty to trudge towards the Polizei, the trap rattled up the steep main road of Meringen. Even this late in the season, snow piled on the pavements. It had been there since last autumn. The dirty grey banks were studded with lumps of dog shit. Baedeker's misses that detail. Every building in sight was a hof of some sort. They competed for custom with themes and gimmicks. The Englischer Hof hoped to attract visitors from our shores with a Union Jack hung upside down, conveniences labelled Victoria's and Albert's, and the menu offering such British fare as fish and shits, squeak and bubble, and plump duff. After the night's travel, I was hungry, but not enough to risk Swiss shits for breakfast. Leaving the trap, I realized another reason why Moriarty had gone off first. He had stuck me with paying the coachman. Funds were becoming an issue. We'd left England with bandoliers full of sovereigns under our combinations. Unavoidable expenses had mounted. We'd skipped out of the Beau Rivage, where we'd registered as Gilbert Smythe and Sullivan Jones, without settling the bill. Our London accounts and cash stashes were beyond reach. Our line of credit with any Continental Box Brothers associate was cut off when someone shot Uli Munster in the head. We were in danger of running out of money. If this holiday went on much longer, I might have to resort to picking pockets, getting up card games with strangers in hotels, or lifting the wallets from any corpses we might leave in our wake. Warily, yes, more than usually so, I did a recce. No assassins hidden in the snow piled up against the back of the Englischer Hof. I entered the lobby, which adjoined the breakfast room, and assumed a downcast, solemn air. I was under orders to examine the body, then disclaim Sophie, leaving funeral costs to whoever might be stuck with them. More penny-pinching. Still, when you're dead, you don't care whether you're under marble or in a sack. However, when you're alive, you eat breakfast. Just as I was about to ring the desk bell, I happened to glance into the dining room. Among the tourists, several with limbs in plaster from skiing, sat Sophie Keratides, tucking into a kipper. The dead don't, on the whole, have appetites. Sophie saw me and was surprised. She coughed up a bone, delicately, into a napkin. I couldn't put the pieces together. Then I could. Meringen was a killing box. A tiger pit. For us. I saw faces. English tourists, local guides, busy waiters, a smiling Swiss who had popped up behind the desk like a jack-in-the-box. Any could be Mabuse. Anyone could be anyone. I reached into my coat for my Gibbs.
"I am Peter Stiele," said the Swiss, who hadn't sent a telegram to Geneva. "How may I serve you, sir?"
I was calm.
"I am joining that lady for breakfast," I said. "Bring me anything on the menu that isn't English, and coffee."
"Certainly, sir."
Smiling broadly, I sat down at Sophie's table. Loudly, I said, "Hello, old thing."
not risking a name, since I didn't know what she'd given at the Hof. "Sorry I'm late and all that. Bit of a bother with the trains. Too used to travelling in France and Italy, don't you know? Swiss trains actually leave according to the timetable, would you believe it? Funny kind of foreigners, eh, what? Have you heard the cricket scores?"
"Cricket?" she said, equally loud, eyes wide.
"Yes, old thing. Raffles out for a duck against the Australians." Coffee arrived.
Under her breath, Sophie said, "What are you doing here?"
"Waltzing into a trap, I think. You'll note who isn't here with me, and probably saw this coming." Sophie took a grip on her toast knife. "All around, people were convivial. Conversation, clattering, someone trying to learn to yodel, noisome gustation. A bit too normal and busy. Then I really saw the faces. One of the young English lady tourists was Chinese, the daughter of the dragon. The dirndl and clogs maid who brought the coffee was Araun, Mabuse's odd companion. Irma Vep peeped out from behind a Times held upside down. She was sharing a plate of croissant with Princess Zanoni. Leaning on a broom and trying in vain to look inconspicuous was none other than the Hoxton creeper, dressed in lederhosen and a sou'wester. A waiter trundled a trolley bearing a covered plate to our table. He lifted the cover and took up a revolver. It was Rupert of Henshaw.
"Come down in the world, Rupert," I asked. "I hear the succession went badly for the Michaelists. A proper conspirator knows not to kill his favoured claimant in a fit of pique before the crown is on his head. Still, I didn't think you'd have to go into service."
Henshaw laughed, showing teeth. Sophie stuck her knife through his hand and he dropped the gun. He was still laughing when he got a look down the barrel of my Gibbs, but there were tears in his eyes. All noise in the room had stopped.
"Sebastian," said a familiar feminine American voice, "put the pistol away. One of these days it'll go off and you'll do yourself an injury."
"Good morning, Irene," I said, not lowering the Gibbs. Irene Adler was not dressed for the mountains, but for an opera set in the mountains. Trim Norfolk jacket, tight breeches, polished boots, dear little hat with a feather in the band. She sat herself down opposite Sophie and me. My companion reached for the pot to fling scalding coffee at the New Jersey Nightingale's face. It was empty.
"I thought of that, Miss Caratides," said that bitch sweetly. "Rupert didn't see the cutlery coming, though."
The rascal was levering the knife out of his hands. I hoped marmalade would make the wound go septic. He came at Sophie, intent on cutting her nose off with her own knife.
"Stand down, boy," Irene said. "Heel."
Reluctantly, he stopped. "It's just hired guns, then," I said. "No Jack Quartz or Nicola or Mabuse. This is below stairs."
"No Moriarty, either," she said.
I knew I could shoot Henshaw. His swordsmanship would avail him little with that injured paw, though he was a left-hand dagger-in-the-clinch sort of fellow. With mixed feelings, I could pot Irene from where I sat. Sophie had more knives, and forks, and spoons. People forget you can do damage with them, too. She could take Araun, probably Zanoni, but we'd go under. Force of numbers. Irma Vep, the daughter of the dragon, the creeper. Younger, stronger, less vulnerable. Plain, better. If this was Basham Moran's last stand, come on and let it be.
"We want to talk about Professor Moriarty and Dr. Mabuse," Irene said. "We want to talk about diabolical masterminds in general. Are you prepared, Sebastian, to talk with us?"
There was a fuss at the door, which was locked.
"I am sorry, sir," Peter Steiler said out in the lobby. "A private party."
"This note says an Englishwoman needs a doctor," said a fatuous British voice.
Dr. Watson had arrived.
Irene cocked her head. It seemed Watson had been halfway to Reichenbach with his chum when he was recalled to Meringen by a bogus summons to the bedside of a lady in distress. Watson was as partial to the bedsides of ladies in distress as I am to the beds of ladies who'll probably end up in distress, but won't care about it for the next hour or two. He exchanged gasps of astonishment with Steiler as he tumbled that he'd been rooked. He used language in person that he'd never put in the Strand. Throughout this performance, the private party was silent. Rupert wrapped a towel round his hand to staunch the bleeding. Irma stood up and, showing nursing skills surprising in someone who kept failing to keep her chiefs alive, made a good field dressing out of the towel. She licked her lips at the sight of blood, and her eyes shone.
Le Vampire was just a name, though, right? Eventually, Watson cleared off.
We should have let him join us, Irene said. He's properly of our party, too. Enthralled to, well, we could hardly say an angelic mastermind, could we? Not of someone who ditches his own sidekick as he goes to confront his destiny.
16.
What of Moriarty and Mabuse? I wasn't there, so I can't tell you of their last encounter, and neither left a record. Mabuse had a face in Meringen, of course. The police captain. Captain of 2 constables and a cart horse, at least, Moriarty had called on. Alraun, Mabuse's date at the Thorogood funeral, told Irene that much, though she was as in the dark about his stratagems as we all were about those whose standards we flew. Ties of blood, bed, tradition, and terror did not entitle us to be in the know. Not all of those present at breakfast in the Englischer Hof were declaring independence. The daughter of the dragon, though she later set herself against her father for the love of some white fool, thought a thinning out of the lesser mastermind population would benefit the Siphon. It was a Moriarty trick, the Battle of the 6 Maledictions all over again. This time, only 2, 3 if we counted the thin man, players were to take each other off the board. Moriarty knew who he was facing. Mabuse knew what to expect. Theirs was a brief meeting, over by the time Irene sat down at our table. It left Mabuse naked in the face, layer upon layer of makeup flayed away and broken in mind. I don't know how Moriarty did it, or at what cost to himself. I fancy he just uttered a formula, forcing into his pupil's mind an addictive, insoluble equation Mabuse was compelled to devote all his intellect to working out, but which opened up vast chasms of uncertainty. The man who was no one was condemned to a world where nothing was anything. Babbling in several languages, the nameless man was found by the bewildered constables and taken away to an asylum. Later he was let out, and returned to Berlin and his old tricks. However, he was never the same again, and was eventually defeated by his own madness. If no one stopped them, bested them, or killed them, the clever ones all drive themselves mad in the end. They look for nemeses, and, if none are available, make them up. I've heard it said that Moriarty was the thin man. I understand why people jumped to that conclusion, for the one needed the other. In the way neither needed anyone else, not Dr. Watson, and not Colonel Moran. That was what Irene wanted to talk about. I don't know if any of the big brains put her up to it, the ones who are so clever they can put an idea into another person's head without them knowing it, or if it was something she'd come up with on her own, one-tier-down level of cunning and self-interest. A lot of it came, I think, from trying to get close to men, or a man, who would not let her in. That's above my level, though. She knew how to put it to me. "Hunter and hunted," she said. "You say that in your book, which could afford to lose the chapters about guns, by the way. That the world is divided between the two types. To avoid becoming one, you must become the other. Do you still believe that, Sebastian?" "Yes, of course. The hunter and the hunted, predator and prey, alive and dead, the guns and the bag?" "At present I have a gun, aimed at you, Irene." "It hasn't escaped my notice, but Sebastian, you miss a category. Native bearers, guides, orderlies, hounds, where do they fit in? Neither hunter nor hunted. Of the party of the hunter, but not the hunter, small lives. To quote you, a currency to be spent freely for a chance of a clean shot. In this coming world, Moriarty outlined, of very great villains and equally magnificent heroes, are we not such a currency? Are we not native bearers? I might have shot her. My finger tightened involuntarily on the trigger. It would have been only fair, for she had shot me, with the worst, most deadly ammunition. Purer than a silver bullet. The truth. Steiler came into the breakfast room with another of his notes, this time for me, from Moriarty. "Mabuse broken. Come to the falls. The hide we scouted. Bring the von Herder. On my signal, take the shot. M." On the journey we had discussed this. The hide he mentioned was a perfect lay, marked on a tourist map Moriarty had given me. "Sebastian,
Irene said. Your master whistles.
17. So we come to it. Above the Reichenbach Falls. I had my lay. I set out well after Watson, who was rushing back up the mountain, but was at the falls comfortably before him. Forward planning, you know. Always a good idea. Moriarty was a master at it. From my snug nest in the snow, I had a good view. The roar of the torrent was muted. I saw the narrow path and judged where the antagonists might meet. A ledge, cropping out with a grassy patch. No easy way to avoid a determined enemy there. The thin man thought a few Japanese wrestling tricks would serve him in a fight with an old math tutor. He'd not seen the professor kill two Swiss wardrobe carriers, the only souls I ever saw him personally murder, by the way, with a letter opener. If it came to a grapple, it would be a more even contest than the detective knew. With Deadeye Moran in hiding to ensure the outcome, it was no contest at all. The Von Herder was assembled, loaded, and primed. It took 20 minutes vigorous pumping for a single shot. Once the gun was discharged, I'd be reduced to chucking rocks. As I said, I usually need a single shot. I had a small pile of rocks ready, though, more planning. I was flat out, on a blanket of fresh snow, not the foul stuff back at the village, but a white, crisp, cold, virgin fall. The air was thin, and I was quite merry. Your brain gets like that in the mountains. You can hear bells and birdsong and voices in the waterfall if you let yourself. I had the stock to my cheek, the telescope sight to my eye. There was no more firm. It was smashed and scattered. In his talk of starting anew, Moriarty had spoken in the singular person. There was no we in his world. I had prospects. Even without funds, I had my wits, and Sophie was handy. I had not been netted by Scotland Yard, and even had the last of my reputation as a hero of the Empire and a cool hand in a crisis. In time, London would welcome Basham Moran. I could always get up a hand of high-stakes whist at the Bagatelle Club. Tiny figures were struggling down the mountain path. Through the telescope sight, I saw the antagonists come face to face. They had words. They broke off. One scribbled a note he left on a rock. A notice of the cancellation of milk delivery in Baker Street? I saw two masterminds, two hunters, two tigers. From my perch above them, they were small boys playing fight. A red and a white ant. Bacteria. Then it was on. Professor Moriarty and Sherlock Holmes rushed at each other. Moriarty raised his arm, the signal. I took my shot. That was The Hound of the D'Urbervilles by Kim Newman, read by Tom Hodgkins.